Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, a talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Total Education Show. I'm the host of the show, Neil Haley. Again, go to the website, TotalTutor.net, to find out more information on the Total Education Network. Well, Jared always waits to hear what happens with me. Well, he is not on Facebook, and I feel bad for him. This week, I interviewed some Carl Banks from the New York Giants Hall of Famer and also Lisa Gibbons. So I am becoming this celebrity guru interviewer. But one of the celebrities I want to welcome to the program is my main man, my co-host of my book that soon should be out, Jared, how are you?
Well, thanks, Neil, and I'm always very pleased and happy and quite proud to be associated with the likes of the celebrity status that you are bringing to the radio show.
Exactly, and I think what Lisa and I had a good conversation and basically saying there's no forum out there for celebrities to talk about their foundations. And I think that's where I said about your sons or the go to the foundation with them and bring celebrities on as well, because they'll spend 2 minutes talking about it, but they want to know about that celebrity's life. They don't want to know about truly what the foundation does. And that's what those spokespeople are there for. People buy tickets, meet them or different things, but they don't see the passion of that celebrity for that foundation and why they're out there. And I think that's a key thing. And Lisa's hopefully going to introduce me to Bill Rancic, because they host a show on America Now. And then she's also going to pass all my information to other people. So we'll see. It's all about interviewing the next person. And then this weekend I'm broadcasting in Pittsburgh, but live for 2 days, the Miami Book Fair, so you'll have to listen. All right, Jared, our topic, I'm excited to go back to occupational therapy, as I've given a kind of a whole warm-up of what's happening. We're going to talk about occupational therapy again, and this time go with sensory issues, which is really related a lot to autism.
Well, this can actually be kind of a confusing topic, especially when you're really kind of focusing on early intervention. A lot of times the first thought that we can apply is that, the child is struggling with kind of organizing the sensory input. And a lot of times that is accurate. The nervous system, particularly in infants, is very underdeveloped, very immature. And one of the best ways I like to highlight that, and I've mentioned this on the show before, is that, we'll see an infant who is crying, and the adults around just cannot meet a child's needs. Can't even figure it out. We've changed the diaper. We have fed the baby. We've rocked the baby. None of those things are working. At that point, you really, and this doesn't mean that it's a deficit or even a deficiency. What we're seeing is that the child is having some difficulty, showing some challenging behaviors associated with regulating the sensory input. So one of the basic ways to explain it is, beginning at birth and going all the way until we've drawn our final breath. We as people collect sensory input, hearing, light, touch, smell, and we draw information from that. And that keeps us, it gives us really the most basic concept of that. And sometimes, and we've all experienced this, perhaps when we're tired, we have sensory overload. The music's too loud. The lights are too bright. The odors are too strong. And all of us have these moments. What happens in early intervention sometimes is that we discover that a child is really facing some challenges associated with integrating the sensory input. And by integration, we simply mean organizing how they process it.
It has a lot to do with the brain, which we talked about, I guess, even in fine motor skills. But in this point, it's really brain development nothing else. It's not the, and when you're talking about sensory, when you're talking about other parts of occupational therapy, like fine motor skills, that's a different story. But when you're talking about something like sensory overload in a way, that's all involving the brain, right?
Absolutely. And that's why with particularly infants, we see that they are really at certain points incapable of processing it. They've actually hit an overload stage. And that's where we again suggest to families that they remove as much of the sensory input as they can. If there's barking dogs, let's move as far away from those barking dogs. If we're hearing car horns, let's go into a deep part of the house where it's going to be quieter. We're going to set those lights down low. We're going to give that child a chance to you're going to help that child's nervous system and brain kind of organize in a way that they're just not quite capable of doing it. And again, I'll go back to one of my best, I think one of the best examples. I don't know what our listeners think. I'll provide what I think is a good example of this. You know, our brain, we're not born with this. We're definitely hardwired for it, but we're not necessarily pre-wired. And what happens is, you know, as adults, we're in a crowded restaurant, all kinds of noise, all kinds of lights, and you hear your name called. Somebody says, Neil. There could be five other Neils. I doubt that in that room, but there could be five other Neils. Yet, all of that noise, all of the chaos that is going around, and you stop your conversation and you begin to look around. Your brain has totally filtered out all of the other sensory input that is being kind of provided in that situation, and focuses on a word, a sound that they know. In my dad's case, you know, when he was alive, for him it was swear words. Everything could be going on around him, and yeah, you know, we're at a baseball game. He's watching the game. And he hears a swear word, and he suddenly has stopped everything. He turns around. His brain was wired to pick up on that.
Wow, okay.
And children just don't have that. But they learn it, and they learn it with our help. So now, as a parent, you feel like your child may have some sensory issues. There's processing. You go to the grocery store, and as you're entering the colder sections, in the warmer sections, you're noticing your child's getting fussy. You go under the fluorescent lights and the buzzing seems to, you may not notice the buzzing, the parent, the adult may not notice the buzzing, but you notice your child is starting to react in different ways. Again, we can't turn off all that sensory input. It's just not going to happen. So the parent, we help the parent with some suggestions to kind of guide their child in dealing with that.
Oh, absolutely, Jared. And I think that's the thing. So how can we, what types of tips would you offer to improve certain sensory issues, especially when we're talking about autism? Because there are a lot of strategies that a lot of families miss out on to really change their child as an autistic child to have a more productive part of their lives, not so difficult and challenging for mom and dad, but also for the child.
But, you know, let's, one of the more common, and again, every child is different within every spectrum behavior, every disorder, like my son even has, every child is completely different. But let's take one of the more common, kind of challenges that parents face, and that is tactile touch. A child on the spectrum may have, particular challenging behaviors, difficulty integrating tactile input, touch input. They may avoid what we might not view as unpleasant. Here's one of the best examples I had. I visited a child on the spectrum for quite some time, and this child reacted strongly with anything that was a tag on their shirt. Yeah, I'm talking about the tag that tells you where the front and the back is.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Adult, we might say, you know, how can that be such a big deal? But for that child, for whatever reason it was unpleasant. So I put it out there right now to our listeners. I bet you they have great ideas that they would be thinking of right now. But one of the strategies that I use for that parent is I said, okay, we've identified this. We know this. He's pulling on it. He's even taking off the shirt. He even sees the shirt with the tag and moves away from it. I said, let's cut out the tag. Let's cut it down as low as we can. Another option, lots of children's clothes now are just made with an imprinted front and back or back on the side with the laundry care. So tags are avoided altogether. And for that child, that worked wonderfully. So making a simple environmental change, strategy number one, see if you can eliminate those, the input that seems to be unpleasant for the child.
So that has to do with anything that I see a lot of children with autism, they really don't like to wear tennis shoes. So they wear, let's say, Crocs, or they wear some sort of, slipper types of stuff. And then there's others that don't like the sweaters, so they make sure, or buttons, or certain things. So I guess what you're saying, and one of the things is don't aggravate them if it could be a quick change.
Exactly. For me, it's cotton. I like the feel of 100% cotton. Anything that is, kind of a polyester blend or a nylon, I just don't like it. I don't like it on my skin. So me, colder weather's approaching, all my thermal undershirts, thermal underpants that I use when we go skiing, they're all cotton. I like the way that feels. What have I done? I've made an environmental modification.
Okay, so that's one of the strategies, and we probably only have time for one more, and we'll have to continue with sensory because it looks like sensory is a long time.
Let's take another example here, and this is, again, let's stay on the topic of tactile integration. Feeding. Your child is showing not quite at the ability to be able to use utensils yet. They're finger feeding. Lots of foods that actually present kind of challenges for families. Childs may not like the messier foods, the wetter type foods, kind of those hard grab foods, pastas, any kind of noodle, macaroni and cheese. Some children, wouldn't matter. My son, he would pick up anything and eat it. Didn't matter. For other kids that I have visited, though, that presented a really big problem. So, again, here's where we came up with some strategies with the family. If it was mac and cheese, let's eliminate the cheese part of it. Let's just see how the child does with the noodle. Might be all that we need to do. The other approach is you keep trying it. Now, don't give up on that first time. Don't give up on the second time. Try it three or four times. The more we have experienced some of the approaches that we, the more we have a chance to actually process that sensory information, the more comfortable we might get with it. And that's including a child on the spectrum. So one method is to avoid it, modify the environment. The other idea is, okay, if it's not anything that we see as dangerous and something that is really creating a kind of overload, let's keep trying it.
All right. Well, that's quite interesting. We'll continue with occupational therapy because it looks like it's something that's not going to end very soon, and it's perfect for book number two. Thanks again for calling the program, Jarrett, and we'll look forward to next week's segment on the network, and we'll just keep plugging away. Before you know it, we'll be in L.A., and we'll be all over the world, and everyone will know who we are. And that's the goal, and because we really want to help people. So thanks for calling.
You got it, Neil. Thank you.
All right, take care, Jared. Okay, bye. You're listening to the Total Education Show on the Total Education Network, and we'll be back in just a moment. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Total Education Show. I'm the host of the show, Neil Haley. Again, go to the website, TotalTutor.net, to find out more information on Total Education Network. Now syndicated 90-plus stations. Go to the website, check it out. It's owned and birthed through College Tutor and Consulting Company. Well, exciting week of interviews, and I always enjoy the education show because we really get into to discuss the K through 12 situations, how to help families out and everything. So I want to welcome to the program Dr. Von Lauer. Dr. Von, how are you?
I'm doing well, Neil. And you?
I'm good. I'm good. Again, I'm ready for 2013. It seems like we're flying through. Holidays are coming up. And it'll be a little bit of slow time, but it'll be a good time to refresh ourselves for the new year. So, Dr. Von, what's our topic for tonight?
I thought we'd address the question of what are unreasonable accommodations. And I'm sure the audience has familiar with the word accommodations and thinks of special education, but the only law or regulation that references reasonable accommodations is something called Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. And if anybody's to look it up, you're going to find that it's a bit out of date in terms of terminology because it hasn't been revised. To catch up with the changes reflected in IDEA. I think the first thing is to ask, what is an accommodation? And it really is a provision of something that enables somebody with a disability to, in our case, access learning, and that allows for the measurement of their skills, compensating to some extent for the disability. And it's not a modification like a change of a curriculum or watering down of a curriculum, and it's not something that can lessen the requirements for graduation, just to name two areas. So let's start with 504 and answer the question of what is the purpose of 504. And it's interesting to note that it's a civil rights law, very much like IDEA, and it was put into place to prohibit the discrimination on the basis of disability in programs and activities, and this is fascinating, for both public and private organizations that receive federal financial assistance. So the catch is, if you are in receipt of federal monies, then you immediately fall under the requirements of 504 to provide accommodations both to adults, colleges, university, and schools, through 12.
So it's different in the fact that an IEP cannot be utilized in a private school, but a 504 plan can.
IDEA, you can have an IEP in a private school, but then the state or the district has to agree that the services are going to meet the IEP that they wrote or that the private school wrote. The public education district is still responsible for them, but oversight and is still with the school district. I'm afraid I'm getting myself a little stumbled here.
Not a problem.
All I'm trying to say is that IEPs can be provided in private schools and public schools as long as they're approved by either the state or the district. It meets the child's needs.
And it varies also, Dr. Von, because in like the way we in Western Pennsylvania state it, that guess what? If you have an IEP and you go to a Catholic school and we do not have to provide the services for that IEP. So I guess I think that that's where I was saying the 504 is more likely to be in both private and public school all the way up to college than possibly an IEP.
Yes, you are correct. And if it's not there, then for adults, it's found under American with the Disabilities Act. So that's a civil rights law that prohibits discrimination, period, based on somebody having a disability. So at this point, if you have a disability, you're pretty much provided some protection, significant protection from discrimination, and that was the intent, really, of all of the laws. There was a point when people with disabilities were discriminated. They did not get education. They didn't get to be employed at various places, and so these laws were put into effect. And I think that's a great thing. Of course I do. All right. Who are these folks under 504? By definition, a federal language, it's anyone who has a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities or has a record of such an impairment
or, and this is the one that's wide open, is regarded as having such an impairment. That's why courts exist, to define what that last one means. I don't have an answer for you today, but it is wide open.
So the next, go ahead. So I was going to talk about, I guess, what we're looking at then, I guess, is what is a reasonable accommodation versus not reasonable then?
Yes, and that's what we're moving to. The reason education falls under 504 is because, as defined again under 504, major life activities includes the word learning. So schools become incorporated in that. And there is no further definition within 504 that helps us quantify or qualify what those accommodations are. And I almost jumped to the end of my presentation by saying, you know, what is an unreasonable accommodation? Well, it's determined by the courts. It really is. And rather than go through that process, districts will work, and this is important for people to know, will work to put those accommodations in place. The one caveat to this is that the school district would be expected, or the school or the classroom, actually, teacher, would be expected to put it into place unless whatever that accommodation is affects the quality of the program or service. So if we think about what an accommodation might be, let's say the child has problems with executive functioning and can't remember to write down the assignment for the day. A lot of schools use something called an assignment notebook. I'm sure you're familiar with it.
Yes,
or
I am. Mm-hmm.
Something very similar to. And the teacher checks off and says, great, the kid wrote down the assignment for the day. This is correct, and, you know, initials, and the student goes off to the next class. And it's not supposed to take a lot of time. But imagine if a teacher has five assignment notebooks to review or more. As we all know, especially in high school, if we think of that, there was very little time to get from one class to the other class. And a teacher has to prepare herself for that as well. And teachers don't necessarily have a room that they stay in and may have to go elsewhere. So if she's held or he's held to working on these notebooks, somebody could ask the question, wait a minute, isn't that interfering with her ability to continue teaching as the other class is coming through the door? It's oversimplified, but it's an explanation of saying, oh, it's going too far. And then you can sit down with a team of people, much like an IEP team, and say, what other options do we have? A suggestion that I heard about the other day and kind of kicked myself was, a child, they all have, almost all of them have cell phones where they can take pictures. And why not then take pictures of the assignment right off the board? You've got a record of it, and it doesn't involve the teacher. That's an account. It's an allowance of the use of a cell phone that the rest of the school may not be able to do. Other kids have to keep their cell phones in their pockets, not to be seen, but we're allowing the child to use some form of technology that he or she has to capture the assignment for the day. Takes care of the assignment notebook. And that's fine for older students, but not so much for little guys. So I thought that was interesting. The biggest accommodations that seem to be used, that are used in schools, is extended time. And that is allowing extra time for a student to take a test or an assignment. If it's due the next day, they may be allowed to turn it in one or two days later. This really surfaces as an issue when students are in high school and preparing for the SATs or whatever assessment they need to take to get into the colleges or universities. And I will tell you that unfavorably, but it happens, parents will ask that a child be classified under 504, special education, as having attention deficit disorder, just so they can get extra time taking tests and assignments,
especially like the SAT, ACT type of exam. That if they can get, that a 5 and 4 written with some sort of diagnosis, then they get the extra time that could give them that step up advantage to get into the schools they want to get into.
And the problem that the people have in the schools is what, you know, the child is doing quite well in school. What is it that he doesn't need extra time? He's doing well. He's getting A's and B's, and it's one of those, I know what you're doing, but we're really not, we're not helping the student. And that's my personal opinion, and I shouldn't have voiced it. But anyway, extended time is fair, and mostly applied to students with attention deficit disorders. One thing I didn't say and should have earlier is all students under IDEA are immediately captured on a 504. So if you can picture 504 as a big umbrella with IDEA under it, kids qualify under both. And sometimes folks would go to the regulations under 504 to get the services that they might not get under IDEA, although you can get almost anything under IDEA in terms of accommodation. The last area is assessment accommodations. And I know you're familiar with that, and I'm sure those who are parents who are listening or educators certainly know about the assessments and the accommodations that are provided so that students can take the assessment and not have the disability get in the way. The issue there is I can provide an accommodation as long as I don't jeopardize the meaning and value of the test that the child is taking. The assumption is that those accommodations are being provided in all classes so that it's not a surprise when the child goes to take the SAT or the state assessments and suddenly a computer is put under her nose and says, okay, you have to put everything on a computer because we have it in your IEP or 504 plan. I know that sounds silly, but it can happen.
Right. So, Dr. Vaughn, I guess what we're basically hearing is that there is really no, I guess, not reasonable accommodation out there. I think that a child with a 504 plan needs to have those accommodations to be successful, and we shouldn't knock it. Do you agree with me on that?
Yeah, I do. If I understood you, what was your last word again?
Knock it. We shouldn't knock it. We should say that they shouldn't have accommodations.
That's right. I do agree to that. But based on the student's needs and observed behaviors, not just willy-nilly, and that's the real issue. It's got to be specific for the child, and it's got to benefit the kid. It serves no purpose just to say, okay, you've got extra time. And that comes into play for a kid with executive functioning problems, whether 504 or IDEA. If that child's given extra time and doesn't know how to use it, then it's of no benefit at all.
Exactly. So if you're a teacher out there writing the 504 or IEP, you got to make sure that the accommodations or adaptations that are made to the curriculum are reasonable, that really are helping the child and not just kind of just being something out there that's not a benefit to either the school or the family.
And I think you just answered the question. Nicely done.
Well, thanks. All right. So,
I'm serious. Anybody who's interested, I can send a document, and I will send to you a differentiation between ADA and IDEA and 504. I think it's just a nice reference. And if anybody's interested in a real expert in the area of 504, it's Terry Zirkel. Zirkel. He works at Lehigh University, right there in Pennsylvania. And if there's anybody who doesn't, I mean, anybody who has all the answers, Perry does. He's just very much on top of 504 and IDEA. So I want to get that in there very quickly.
All right. Okay. Where can we find more information on you, Dr. Vaughn?
At my website at educationallearningandtraining.com. Educational learning and training is all one word. And if you go to the last page, you can see where you can request information on anything I've discussed today, and I'd be happy to get it to you.
All right. Well, thanks again for calling.